The Majority Report. Everything shitty about liberals in one hunched over, lying, screaming, banal, trite human container. Like a one-stop shop museum for what is so repellent about liberal discourse. That's The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Thursday, April 1st, 2021. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Cedar, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, obviously it's April Fools, Ken Klippenstein of The Intercept joins us to discuss his multiple scoops on Amazon's workplace practices. Meanwhile, President Biden is facing pressure from progressives to increase the size of his infrastructure deal, with the $2.25 trillion figure coming in as lower than was rumored, and with a lot less Green New Deal in that infrastructure package. More on that later. Up to 15 million Johnson & Johnson vaccine doses were contaminated with, well, ingredients were mixed up at a Baltimore factory. However, over 2.8 million shots are being administered throughout the country every day, although COVID cases continue to increase. Here in New York, Governor Andrew Cuomo attempts to take heat off of himself by caving to two progressive priorities that he'd spent years stifling: marijuana legalization and a bill that limits solitary confinement in prisons. Great, but we don't forget, dude. Four people were killed in yet another mass shooting yesterday, including a child. It occurred at an office complex in Orange County, California. More details aren't known yet. Embattled Representative Matt Gaetz is telling the media that he has offers on the table from Fox News, OAN, Newsmax, and more, even after news broke that he is under investigation for an alleged relationship with a 17-year-old girl. But a Fox News source tells the Daily Beast that such conversations never happened, and that they have, quote, no interest in hiring him. Delicious. The World Resources Institute has found that tropical forest destruction increased by 12% last year despite economic slowdowns due to the pandemic. Experts estimate that this added over 2.5 billion metric tons of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. The Supreme Court sided with the Trump administration's FCC, News Corp, Sinclair Broadcasting, and more, unanimously loosening restrictions on broadcast companies to allow for further consolidation, just what we need. And lastly, in Myanmar, the military has shut down wireless internet service again, I believe, until further notice, as protests against the coup continue to rage. All this and more on today's program. Gotta be quick out there, right? Here, I'm gonna play this because it's April Fool's Day. This is my addition to the soundboard.
Quick, you got 1 minute. 1 minute, Martha's sake. They don't want to hear this, Martha. Come on, let's go. Quick. Come on, let's go.
How's everybody doing today? Welcome to the show. Let's begin talking about Biden's infrastructure package, which he unveiled yesterday in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Here he is talking about how he is choosing to increase taxes on people making over $400K a year, plus increasing the corporate tax rate in order to fund said infrastructure package.
As I said, 4 years ago, as I said, the Congress passed a tax cut of $2 trillion, increasing the national debt $2 trillion. It didn't meet virtually any of the predictions it would in terms of growing the economy. Overwhelmingly, the benefits of that tax package went to the wealthiest Americans. It even included new investments that would you profit by shifting profits and jobs overseas if you're a corporation. It was bad for American competitiveness, deeply unfair to the middle-class families, and wrong for our future. So here's what I do. I start with one rule. No one, let me say it again, no one making under $400,000 will see their federal taxes go up, period. This is not about penalizing anyone. I have nothing against millionaires and billionaires. I believe American capitalism. I want everyone to do well. But here's the deal. Right now, middle-class couple, a firefighter and a teacher with two kids making a combined salary of, say, $110,000, $120,000 a year, pays 22 cents for each additional dollar they earn in federal income tax. But a multinational corporation that builds a factory abroad, brings it home and sells it, they pay nothing at all. We're going to raise the corporate tax. It was 35%, which is too high. We all agreed 5 years ago it should go down to 28%. Mm. But they reduced it to 21%. We're going to raise it back to up to 28%. No one should be able to complain about that. It's still lower than what that rate was between World War II and 2017. Just doing that one thing will generate $1 trillion in additional revenue over 15 years.
Did I? I must have missed that the first time I watched that clip. Did he really say we all agreed to put the corporate tax rate down to 28% from 35%?
Yeah, I mean, that's really the problem with this whole clip is he's so concerned with, you know, making sure he's not seen as raising taxes on anybody who says below 400K, right? And that ultimately, I think, why the AOC clip is important is, and I'll get this also this graph that will show about the actual tax burden.
Get that right. I agree with you, Matt. I mean, that he spends the whole clip for some reason, or the whole 2 minutes of that speech, on the defense for literally no reason. This is an overwhelmingly popular idea. Sell it to people, because what you're doing is the bare minimum. Again, the Trump administration cut the corporate tax rate from 35% to 21%. Biden wants to put it back up to 28%. That is the bare minimum. And yet he's trying to make it seem like this is a middle ground approach to put it back up to 28%. No, it should be higher than 35%. Why are you making the Republicans' case for them? He slipped back into 1990s, don't talk about raising taxes, Biden, when he really could just make the case that this graph here makes, Matt. We can play it as we talk about this. So look at how started from, well, this is at the end of the graph.
Yeah, I'll restart here in a second.
This is how taxes, there we go, for earners, the highest tax rate has gone down over the years. You see all the way up there at 70% in 1950, in the 70s, it's fluctuating around the 40s and 50s, in the 80s, steep cuts, continues to go down, continues.
Meanwhile, getting slightly more and more regressive on the lower end the entire time.
And now here we are in the 2000s, below 30, continuing to go down. Obama nominally raised it. And then 2018, we're all the way down at that 20 or at the, what was the figure for people earning that amount of money? I'm not exactly sure, but we're already down there. So Biden could have spent his time making that case as opposed to talking about why he's meeting the Republicans in the middle ground there. This is a no-brainer approach to raising revenue, and it should be treated with aggression by the Democratic Party. It should be more than what Biden is proposing, and you should not be constantly on the defense and explaining yourself, because that makes you sound weak. And the proposal in and of itself of raising taxes on high-income earners and corporations is wildly popular.
So, yeah, and you're right. It is like the playing defense thing, because that's where the attacks are coming from the Republicans. It's just like a massive wish list for all the, you know, the things the Democrats want and stuff like that. And you just have to say these things are necessary. It's not a wish list. What we're actually doing is necessary.
Exactly. And not constantly trying to make yourself seem not radical. But let's turn to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Last night, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez went on Rachel Maddow's program to explain why she and her progressive colleagues feel Biden's infrastructure proposal is too small. And I agree with her. Let's take a listen to what she had to say.
Joe Biden said for COVID relief, he wanted $1.9 trillion. Everybody assumed that would get whittled way down and some much smaller package would ultimately pass. It didn't. It did get cut down a little bit, but not that much. It was basically a $1.9 trillion plan. Sounds to me, from what I hear you saying tonight, that on this one, what may happen is that President Biden may say, listen, today in Pittsburgh, I want $2.25 trillion over 8 years. But when it lands in the House, you and your colleagues may say $2.25 trillion is a starting point, but this needs to be a bigger bill. This needs to get larger before the Senate even gets a look at it. Is it fair to expect that that may be the way this goes?
Absolutely. You know, if we could wave a magic wand and there and progressives in the House were able to name any number and get it through, which obviously isn't the case. But if we're looking at ideals and what we think is the actual investment that can create tens of millions of good union jobs in this country, that can shore up our healthcare, our infrastructure, our housing, and doing it in a way that draws down our carbon emissions to help us get in line with the IPCC standards, we're talking about realistically $10 trillion over 10 years. And I know that may be an eye-popping figure for some people, but we need to understand that we are in a devastating economic moment. Millions of people in the United States are unemployed. We have a truly crippled healthcare system and a planetary crisis on our hands, and we're the wealthiest nation in the history of the world. So we can do $10 trillion. It's a, that is a thing of political imagination. However, even when you break it up in that into those two parts, what's important to remember is that this is, actually isn't just a progressive versus a moderate issue. You have some of the most conservative members of the Democratic caucus, like Joe Manchin, that have even signaled support for a $4 trillion infrastructure plan, which mm-hmm. is double in the numbers.
That is incredibly key there at the end, because infrastructure is wildly popular, and a senator like Joe Manchin is going to want that infrastructure to target a state like West Virginia specifically. This is going to go through reconciliation. They're going to get zero Republican votes on this. So there is no excuse for this bill to be as small as it is, even though the Biden administration is claiming this is only half of what they plan to do. Why make it only half of what you plan to do? This is going to go through reconciliation. You can make it as big as you possibly want. And you essentially have to say how you're going to pay for it, which is Biden saying it's going to be on taxing earners, people who earn over $400,000 a year, and raising the corporate tax rate. You know how you could make it bigger, Biden? Is by making the corporate tax rate back to what it was, 35% at a bare minimum, and not going going to 28%. It's going to be a way to raise the necessary revenue if you're that concerned about paying for it through the arcane rules of reconciliation. But what Ocasio-Cortez is saying there, and what a lot of progressives in Congress are saying, is that they are going to start from that $2.25 trillion number and build it up in the House. And then you can use Manchin's own words against him. The thing about Manchin is he'll forget what he said the day before as long as he's able to be at the bill's passage in the 11th hour, able to cut it down and say, look, I made it smaller. I bucked the Biden administration and the socialists like Ocasio-Cortez, basically. But before that happens, it is on her and it is on the other Democrats in the House to make it as large as possible. Because as she makes the case there, the $1.9 trillion stimulus package that was passed in order to allow people to survive and bolster the economy after COVID, that was filled with provisions that are going to expire at maximum over 2 years. This package that's $2.25 trillion is meant for 10 years of infrastructure. That is really not enough when you put it in those terms. So that's why she's saying that $10 trillion figure. It's not going to be that. There's no way. But it's got to be a lot bigger than it is. And I think she's making the case incredibly effectively, especially because not all of the provisions in this bill are targeting climate change in the way that they need to be. This is not even close to a Green New Deal. And Biden is whittling it down for seemingly obtuse reasons, especially when you have a Manchin who's making it clear that he would want something bigger.
Yeah, I mean, it's for reasons of oligarchy, I think. Like, it's because Bill Gates and people like that are talking about, I don't know if you saw Bill Gates's comment, how we need multiple parties, because when you start trying to give everyone a job while you address climate change, then you must be reading Karl Marx and singing the Internationale. Like, that's the mood of the rich and the powerful and who control the economic, you know, priorities of this country right now. And that's what's very frustrating about the Democrats, is like, you think you'd only have to worry about, you know, the actual party caucus and whipping them, but you actually have to, there's these unspoken vetoes by, you know, the money people. And I mean, obviously that exists in the Republicans, but it's very frustrating. I understand when people see it on the Democratic side.
Especially because this has been a strategic move by the Democratic Party to appeal to wealthier people in the country. And you've seen demographic shifts where wealthier donors, now they're trending more Democratic. So part of this is also just appealing to those sensibilities, and you have to fight those forces. And again, the civil war against the corporate wing of the Democratic Party isn't over. And it's just going to get exacerbated when you have those moneyed interests turning to the Democratic Party after they felt very offended by Donald Trump. And Bill Gates is a very vocal voice in that area. We are going to take a quick break, maybe not even a music break, just a pretend break. And then Ken Klippenstein is going to join us to talk about his multiple scoops in The Intercept about Amazon.
We'll bring Ken on now.
No, we'll just bring Ken on. I make it casual here.
If people haven't seen the header for Ken's article about the peen in bottles and the use of the Amazon logo, people should go check that out.
Yes. There he is, except you're sideways, my dude.
Oh, gosh. We don't want that.
Yeah, just do it long ways.
Yeah, you can do it long ways. Oh, there we go.
Perfect. There we go. How you doing, Ken?
I'm doing all right. I heard you guys talking about the article, graphic art, I think, on the story.
Yeah.
Let me just.
Go
ahead.
I got upstaged. Everyone's talking about the art, which they should be, because that was quite a funny picture that they came up with.
If maybe you can pull it up. Basically, Ken has just been on a blitz of reporting on Amazon workers and their internal documents within Amazon that he's been able to get his hands on. So great journalism by Ken. I want to go through all three of those articles that you've passed in the past week, right? So I guess the past 7 or 8 days, the first one that made an incredible amount of waves is the one that Matt may be pulling up here with the artwork of the peeing in bottles one. So here we go. Documents show Amazon is aware drivers pee in bottles and even defecate en route despite company denial, and it's an Amazon arrow going into a water bottle. So good job, Intercept team. There.
Nailed it.
Let's talk about that, though, Ken. So, you know, we have been coworkers in the past. You've always been an amazing journalist, but you're blowing up here. You're getting all these Amazon scoops. This first article, which talked about how Amazon's corporate Twitter account essentially tweeted out, "You don't really believe the peeing in bottles thing, do you?" And they sent out a bunch of denials about the fact that they work their drivers and employees so hard that they have to go to the bathroom in bottles or bags in order to save their jobs. But you got your hands on documents that directly contradict their public denial from Amazon News. Not Amazon PR, aptly named, by the way.
So, you know, there had been reports in the past that this was happening. But what I thought would be interesting is, you know, just talking to some folks and seeing what the prevalence is. Because, you know, does this happen? It seemed pretty clear, judging on the reporting, that it did on some level. But I didn't have a sense of the proportion. And when I started talking to people, there were drivers that told me they're called delivery associates, where they deliver the packages, who told me there's not a single day I go without doing this. And I was shocked at just how commonly it happens. So not only does it happen, and, you know, their PR just lied, and I'm saying lied as in they consciously knew, because when I published, these were internal documents from management discussing the problem and talking about how prevalent it was. That's not to say they did anything about it, because as you say, you know, Amazon, to give the devil their due, they're going to say, oh, we actually don't condone that. We tell people not to do it. And that's true. They do, you know, hope that their employees don't do it. But that's because They don't want it to be seen and found out. And, you know, I talked to so many people where I asked them, I said, so did they change the quotas, these bruising quotas that they have to be, delivery quotas, to make it so that you actually don't have to do these kind of things? And I didn't hear a single person say that there were ever any accommodations made. So the reality is, while they can say they're not making their employees do it, if you're going to get fired, you depend on this job to live. You're going to do what you have to do to get by. I mean, these guys, they don't want to do it. They don't like doing it, but they tell me there's no other way that they're able to hit these quotas that they need to do in order to stay employed.
So one of the documents that you found was marked Amazon confidential. And details, as you write, various categorized as infractions by employees for public urination and public defecation. So basically, outside of their documentation, they're encouraging this kind of practice, or at least turning a blind eye to it, as long as you follow through on the quotas in terms of your deliveries, and then admonishing them, at least in documentation, in confidential documents behind the scenes. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the fact that it's marked confidential, that tells you so much about, you know, their posture with respect to this issue. It's not so much that they don't want it happening, or else I would imagine they could change the quotas. It's that they don't want it coming out. And the emphasis is always public. And it's kind of it seems to me to be a sort of wink, like, you know, if people don't know about it, then that's another thing. But we don't want this coming out. And so at that point, employees I talk to are under pressure, not just to do these things to hit the numbers, but then hide it afterwards because they're terrified of being, you know, found out and getting reprimanded for it. So it's really this, I don't know what word to use other than dystopian, where not only are they having to do these dehumanizing things, they're desperately having to cover it up so that management doesn't see. But I mean, that's what you expect when you put these quotas, you know, person after person I talk to says, how am I supposed to meet 20 stops without doing this? It's not possible. And there's never any accommodations made. So it's disingenuous for them to come out and say, oh, we don't condone this, while at the same time, they do absolutely nothing to try to address why it's happening.
Yeah. This quote from your article struck me. You spoke with a former driver who received a message from her manager that had a section titled urine bottles, and it states, in the morning you must check your van thoroughly for garbage and urine bottle. If you find urine bottles, please report to your leads, supporting staff, or me. I mean, like, check this off the list, check this other thing off the list, and of course, you know, the perfunctory urine bottle in your car. Can you talk about your communications with this former driver and just how that bolstered a lot of what you reported on?
This was so sad. This driver, like others I interviewed, but who, you know, couldn't be named because they're still, this person had quit recently. I had female drivers telling me that they had gotten UTIs for having to do this so routinely. I can't stress enough how frequent this is. Not a marginal thing where, you know, Amazon might say, oh, you know, there are crazy things that happen at every company. We're a huge company of hundreds of thousands of people. Sure, you can find some. That's so misleading. This is solidly within the mainstream of how delivery associates, you know, have to conduct themselves in order to get by. And there are health consequences from it. You know, hearing about these UTIs, hearing about being in physical pain from having to meet these sort of things. There's more than one person I talked to who said physically their body just couldn't take it anymore and they had to quit. And these are a lot of individuals with modest means that can't afford to be moving between jobs unless they absolutely have to. So in the case of this driver, what she told me on the record was pretty much consistent with what everyone was telling me, that I, you know, had to grant them anonymity because I don't want them to get fired because they're not authorized to talk to me. And that is that not only were these bruising quotas always unrealistic, but under coronavirus, it got significantly worse. And there were never any concessions made because suddenly Amazon becomes what should be the government, which is a sort of logistics center for, you know, providing goods and services to people that, you know, need them, are not able to go out to restaurants or not able to go out to grocery stores and things like that. But again, there's no concessions. I'm not saying that you can't have 2-day delivery and things like that. They absolutely can. They would just need to hire more people. And yes, that would cut into profits. But I mean, the reality is they have to choose between human decency and profit. And, you know, the way that corporations are structured, they have no incentive to do anything other than, you know, choose profit as a priority every time. And so it was really, you know, harrowing to see someone, and respect to her for being willing to go on the record and say these things, because that's a big step, you know, to take. Future employers will see that kind of thing. And again, what, you know, I had hoped to use her insights to show people, like, this isn't just, you know, internal documents or reports. Like, here's someone willing to go out and say and put their name on it. And she did it because she was just so angry at how, I don't know, I try to, you know, discuss this in a sort of dispassionate, fact-based way, but I don't know how to say that, like, you don't treat human beings like this. I don't know what else to say. And, you know, that was the feeling I had the entire time researching the stories. I just, it was just this pathos and just this, like, visceral reaction that anybody would do this to humans, much less a huge company that is a major employer in this country and that presumably other, you know, companies are emulating.
Well, we've talked about on the show how a lot of mainstream journalism where they try to divorce any kind of empathy or, you know, I guess passion from their coverage, it results in, like, very horse racy, sociopathic in some ways coverage of politics. So I appreciate your compassion and your empathy in this situation. Let's move on to your next story, because a few days later, again, you published that first story on the 25th, then the 29th, you were able to get your hands on an internal document related to those very corporate tweets that were the catalyst for your first story, which was the denial of the peeing in bottle story, the fact that you had so much evidence and people who spoke to you who confirmed it. And then your second story, entitled Document, Amazon security staff reported its own hostile tweets as suspicious, fearing they'd been hacked. They were really fearful about their brand being, I guess, besmirched, but it seems to me they're doing that themselves. But can you talk about that story and what you found there?
Yeah. So the genesis of all of this, people are like, how do you get so many scoops? As much as I would love to take credit for all that and say, oh, I'm just such a great reporter. The reality is a lot of people were just enraged at what the company was doing. And the mood was one of so many people I talked to. These are not, you know, left-wing radicals that want to, you know, throw out management. A lot of them were just like, I saw the tweets and that's insane. And they're lying. And I want you to know about it. And that was, and so if you go back to the original tweet that started a lot of this, it was the Amazon PR account's response to Representative Mark Pocan, who was criticizing them for their working conditions, mentioning the peeing in bottles. They said, as you mentioned earlier, you don't really believe that, do you? People are real mad about that. Because as I said before, this is a routine practice. It's not any sort of marginal thing. There's no way management doesn't know about it. I mean, we know that they know about it because they've memorialized it in these internal documents and policies. But after that response, there were several other tweets where they replied to Senator Bernie Sanders, Senator Elizabeth Warren, you know, pretty popular senators by the standards of Congress. And they were sort of taunting them. The tone is very interesting, where they're saying, you know, you guys say you want $15 an hour. We actually give it to our employees, very conveniently leaving out the fact that they offered it to their employees after a whole lot of pressure from the Progressive Caucus on exactly that issue.
Bernie Sanders' Stop Bezos Act, they got so spooked by it that they put it into place because they were getting such bad PR from it.
Exactly, exactly. And now they're like, well, we actually did it. And you guys, and it's just so dishonest. I mean, I cannot stress enough how angry people inside the company were. And that's why I started covering, because I don't cover labor stuff very often. I generally cover national security type stuff. I just saw an opportunity here because I know that when they go out and lie like that publicly, that is the perfect conditions for when people want to blow the whistle and talk. But all that being said, what was interesting about all that is that the people inside the communications department, I wasn't just talking to people in the you know, warehouses on the factory level. I was talking to people on the corporate side in the offices. And people in the comms department and sort of adjacent, kind of tangent to it. And they were all horrified at what's happening. And again, these are not left-wing zealots by any means. These included people that were solidly, like, kind of true believers, where they're like, yeah, we want to help the community by giving them goods and services in our two-day delivery, blah, 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 that kind of thing. And they were shocked and terrified at what's happening. There were even just people that were saying, the amount of time it's going to take to put out the fires and to try to regain trust that we've, you know, wiped out with these incendiary tweets to, you know, pretty popular political representatives is going to take probably months or years even. And so I'm talking to them. And then one of them says to me, you know, these tweets were seen as so insane that an engine, I believe it was an Amazon engineer, reported it to Amazon, like info security as a, they thought that the account had been hacked. They were worried that the Amazon's Twitter account, they're like, this has to be hacked. This is so crazy. And then they get the report back. They're like, nope, wasn't hacked. This is someone in senior executive management. And my understanding is that this person is actually going around behind communications and not getting the not going through the usual process where they have to get sign off and things to pretty much prevent exactly these kinds of scandals from happening. And I don't know if this is accurate, but Vox has reported, I don't know this firsthand, but Vox has reported that this is Jeff Bezos himself just railroading this stuff through and, to the displeasure of comms. But that's consistent with what I'm told, which is that there's someone very high up in the company that's mandating these things to happen, much to the dissatisfaction of pretty much everyone else in the firm, it seems like.
Yeah, so I wanted to, you can't independently verify it, but Recode, which is a part of Vox Media, was reporting that this is coming directly from Bezos. So, you know, based on your understanding of Amazon and your past research, who would have the power to kind of circumvent the comms department in this particular way? This seems to be coming from, at the very least, a high-level executive. Like, is it just to bolster this and emphasize it, is it so unusual that that's what seems like a very likely scenario?
No, it's perfectly plausible. And it's plausible that Bezos did. And my understanding is that it is someone very high up, because all the folks in comms were angry about it because, you know, someone's going around behind their back to do these kind of things. And, you know, we'll talk about this in a second, but in my third and most recent story about Amazon, the tone of these tweets, the kind of trolly, kind of provocative, sort of taunting demeanor, that was something mandated by senior leadership within the company, and they think it's a good idea. They think we're going out there and we're defending ourselves. And the Vox story says basically that, which is that Bezos was frustrated that we're not going out there and confronting these guys on their, what he considers their misinformation about the company, and being more aggressive in these kind of things. And that's exactly what it looks like. I just don't know if it's him or if it's some other guy in senior leadership, because that's probably an attitude held by many that, you know, we got to go out there and you know, face these guys down. And then you talk to anyone in comms, they're like, no, that's not what you have to do. We should just ignore these things because there's no upside to it for us to respond to any of this stuff. But, you know, whatever the case may be, certainly plausible and definitely someone in senior leadership from what I understand.
Yeah, it's the thinnest skin people seem to be the most powerful people in the world in some instances. But just to touch on Amazon practices before we move on to your final story, you talk about how within the company, these practices are really part and parcel of their efforts to stifle dissent. Can you talk about how they retaliated against their workers in Chicago and how that fits into the broader picture you're painting here?
Yeah. So during the coronavirus pandemic, there was a big push. And again, I can't stress enough how not political these types of folks are, judging from the conversations that I had with them. Not necessarily conservatives by any means, but, you know, it's not at the front of their minds. A lot of folks, they are trying to survive. They don't have a lot of time to think about this kind of political, you know, abstract stuff. So both corporate and in the warehouses, a lot of them are getting together and saying, OK, how can we continue to work as they want us to do, but do that in a safer way, so that we're not going to, you know, catch this horrible plague and get sick or, you know, die. And so at the corporate level, that took the form of, you know, people kind of getting together in these groups and saying, all right, well, let's present to management this plan. And here's a way we can do it where we can distance ourselves and maybe come to work, but you know, mitigate the kind of risk and try to do something consistent with what CDC is recommending, but that'll work for our workplace. And then in the case of Chicago, there was people actually trying to unionize. And the NLRB, the National Labor Review Board, actually found that there was retaliation, if I remember correctly. And that's not super common. You know, NLRB is not a super powerful organization. And to go up against Amazon like that, I would imagine that what they saw, the evidence that they saw, was pretty persuasive. But whatever the case may be, whether it's that or these groups on the corporate level getting together to try to form these message boards to discuss these things, my understanding is that those message boards were shut down. There were also put into place certain types of barriers that were said to protect them from COVID. But from people I talked to, they were concerned that they were trying to stop association from happening, people interacting, especially during in the context of the union vote. Whether that's what happened, I don't know the people that implemented that, so I can't say for certain. But there's a lot of suspicion on the part of workers about all of these different policies. For example, they took down an internal directory where you can just look people up and Not that it has a ton of personal information, but it might have their phone number and their email or something like that. And suddenly you can't find anyone else to interact with at your job because you don't know that stuff just from your day-to-day, you know, work interactions. And the concern on the part of so many people I talk to is that there's, you know, it's very interesting to them that this happened, you know, coming up to these union votes, that sort of thing. And so from, you know, a number of different angles, the impression was that there were attempts to atomize and keep people apart from each other with respect to the union stuff, but not necessarily taking up the CDC recommendations on the things you need to do to protect people from getting sick of COVID. And so that disjunct, that paradox, I think caused a lot of frustration and is what you're seeing really come to a head. There's this attitude that this stuff comes out of nowhere. That's never true. This thing was building up for the last year of people feeling as though they're not being listened to. And these are not marginal issues listened to on matters of how do I work so I don't get sick with this horrible disease, you know? So that's sort of the context that what we saw over the last week or so is coming out of.
Well, I mean, I'll editorialize and say I have zero doubts that that was an effort to stamp down any kind of, or tamp down, I should say, any unionization effort. Just based on what we have seen in Bessemer as well, it was confirmed by, I believe, The Verge, I think I'm getting that wrong, but that Amazon changed traffic patterns. They changed the length of traffic lights so that union organizers outside of the facility couldn't stop and talk to Amazon workers in their cars in order to aid the fight for Bessemer union organizing. So it's just it's so part of the playbook of what we've seen from Amazon. Then let's move on to your most recent story, which came out 2 days ago. Amazon's Twitter army was handpicked for great sense of humor leaked documents reveal. So you find out that, or leaked document reveals. You found out that basically Amazon had a Twitter bot army that they created under the title Veritas in 2018 as a top secret mission. Can you expand upon that?
Yeah, so this is another matter that was marked Amazon Confidential, which is it's like this cosplay that they think they're in the CIA or something. It almost feels like when you're a kid and you watch the Jason Bourne series and suddenly you're the CIA case officer, all these things. So that's kind of funny in itself. But they use cryptonyms, just like, you know, again, I said before, I don't cover primarily labor stuff. I usually cover national security. And so they use these code words. It's kind of like, what, in a business context? Why are you doing that? And so their code name for this program, which people have been talking about earlier this week, is they saw this army of Twitter users that all have the same format for their Twitter account and their bios. They've got like a box. It's like the delivery. It's supposed to be the delivery box that they do in the warehouses. And they just come out in mass and are saying, you know, it's almost like North Korea. It's like, we love Jeff Bezos, you know, drinks the sun and eats the moon or something. And he's, you know, all this great stuff. So people are like, what the hell is that? And, you know, it is very strange and dystopian. But I started looking at the reporting. There's very little known about this program. So I started asking around. I mean, it's known that there are a bunch of these bots, they're not actually bots. They look like it, but these are actually human beings, real people that work for Amazon are paid to post these things. So I started asking around, like, what is this program? And somebody says to me, oh, he's like, they conceived of it in 2018. It was this big thing that everyone in comms thought was stupid. But I think I still have a report from him. Let me see. So then he sends me this report. I start clicking through it. And so these folks are handpicked to do these kind of sassy clapbacks at like detractors that are criticizing the company. And they're told to, quote, speak your truth. But apparently there are some guardrails. You can't speak your truth about just anything. You can't talk about unionization, for instance. They're explicitly told, don't reply to tweets about unionization. Examples given where I'm paraphrasing, it's like if they hear someone say, let your employees unionize something, they say, don't respond to that. But to a lot of other stuff, not only do you respond, you want to be, quote, one of the words was, I can't remember what the word was again, but they're telling them you can want to come on tough. You want to be bold. You want to be all these things that Vox reported that Bezos said they wanted to be. And so the idea is they're supposed to do these epic dunks. They're supposed to be windmill dunking on the critics. And this is supposed to be good for Amazon, which again, folks in comms thought this was idiotic and they thought this was a crazy idea. But not only do they, you know, authorize these folks to do it, they provide them with training. I think it was like a 1 or 2 week training. And they're handpicking these individuals for what they think is this sort of sassy sense of humor that's going to, you know, make Amazon seem likable. And what's interesting is the folks are picking for these. This was in response to, in part, the urinating in bottles allegations. They're instructed to tell people, well, I never saw that, which is interesting because it's like That doesn't mean it doesn't happen because you're claiming that you didn't see it, but we'll set that aside for a second. Not only are they picking these folks to respond to those kind of things, there's a line in it where they say, you're going to want to, you know, it might be a good idea to pick people that haven't been there very long because they tend to be more enthusiastic about the company. And you can kind of read between the lines about what that means, because maybe they haven't been there long enough to see people urinating bottles and these kind of things. Or, you know, if you're a young kid and you have a new job, you're excited about it at first before you start to realize, you know, how it really goes. And so, you know, all this just goes to show the amount of thought and effort that was put into this thing. This was not an ad hoc decision. There are specific, I mean, they discussed doing these pilot studies, like psychological studies, to try to identify the right people to comprise this Twitter army that they now use. And the idea that they're giving you any sort of representative sample of the people that work in these fulfillment centers is ludicrous. These are very carefully chosen individuals to tell the part of the story that Amazon wants to tell. Or else they would disclose all this stuff and it wouldn't be some secret program codenamed Veritas, which is funny in itself. But that's what we have with the Amazon Twitter army.
Can you talk about how your experience in covering national security overlaps with this? Because so much of this seems like it's like almost CIA propaganda. Touched on it a little bit, but just the scale and the scope of and the breadth of Amazon's influence and power, it's largely unrivaled, I would say.
Yeah, and when you talk to spooks in the, you know, FBI, see, I was talking to a friend of mine in the FBI maybe a year ago or so, and he was like palpably envious of the power that Amazon had. He said, "You guys think that we're, you know, tough cookie. Like, I wish we could do what Google and Amazon does." He says this sort of very cryptically, and I was like, "What do you mean?" He's like, "They have capabilities that we couldn't dream of." And the reality is they own so much of the tech and internet infrastructure that they probably can see a whole lot of what's going on. I know that in my law enforcement sources, a lot of what they're going off of, their subpoenas, they're just subpoenaing these companies that are hoovering up massive amounts of data about all of us. And that's really where I think primarily the threat to privacy is coming from, not from the state, but from these companies that almost think of themselves as these sort of mini nation states in how not just they conduct themselves, but how they try to burrow like termites into the foundations of governments, not just domestically, but overseas. And talking to people, they were describing to me how they were trying to manipulate governments in Europe to try to establish a legal apparatus favorable to the types of products that they're selling and exporting, these kind of things. They really are operating as sort of mini states. And the country needs to have a serious discussion about, you know, antitrust law and how we start to implement that in a serious fashion, because the amount of power after coronavirus, look at the profits that guys like Bezos and these companies, they're just zooming. All these small businesses that died, they've been replaced with these companies. So they're even more powerful than they've been before, even after this catastrophe that so many people lost power and money in any sort of, you know, measurable sense. So that's really what all this illustrates, I think, is the awesome power that these almost robber baron type, you know, business institutions now have and are able to wield over our politics and the public.
Lastly, where do you think it goes from here? The I guess the Democratic Party's approach, and this is just really an editorial question for you, to tech companies like Amazon, because you have Joe Biden speaking out in favor of the unionization effort. And then at the same time, though, the reason that these companies have gotten so large is in part due to the fact that they donated so much money to the Democratic Party, and there's been that cozy relationship. Where do you see this going?
Well, there are two directions. You know, Emma, when I was your age, we had a Democratic Party that, you know, under George Bush, for instance, there really wasn't much in the way of a progressive caucus. I'm not saying that there weren't certain progressive tendencies within it, but they weren't organized and it wasn't large enough to provide a sort of check against, I mean, the number of blue dog Democrats, it's the word they had then for these kind of centrist, kind of like Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema kind of thing, was just overwhelming. And the power they wielded was overwhelming. There was never any question of, you know, what is the conflict? Who's going to win here in the way that we're having with these kind of bills where, you know, the 15 an hour failed. But there were other concessions. At least there's a kind of, there's at least a sort of competition, a conflict, a debate around these sort of things now. And I think much as the same, much the same case with Amazon and how we're going to prosecute. I mean, the Justice Department is in the middle of a huge, I can't remember, maybe it was the SEC. They're in the middle of a big investigation related to all this, because when you integrate, you know, they have control of internet delivery, logistics, all these different things. I mean, it very clearly is monopoly, and there are all sorts of legal issues that come with that. So not only, you know, is the situation ripe for facing something like that, but we are starting to have what looks like, particularly in the House, not insignificant, you know, wing of the party that has a different view than what perhaps the, you know, Chuck Schumer's and Manchin's and things of the past would have. So that's really up in the air. I don't know what's going to happen with that. There's at least a fighting chance now. But, you know, as you see with cases like this, and as you said, for Biden to come out and make that statement, you know, there are detractors who say, you know, it wasn't strong enough. Of course, I'm never going to be happy. I want him to be out there fighting for every strike at the tiniest company, or, you know, but so I agree with you. Always push for more. That said, this was really extraordinary. I don't think we've seen anything like that, in certainly in my lifetime, for a president to come out and make a statement like that. And Amazon is terrified. I can tell you from the people inside that they are, you know, this is a modern day pharaoh. He's the richest man on the planet. Company's worth over $1 trillion. So enormous power. But they wouldn't be as scared as they are if there wasn't a credible threat, and if there wasn't some chance that this unionization push can work. And I think it can. And I think that's why we're seeing a lot of this irrational behavior. I think it's driven by fear and sort of, you know, anxiety over, oh, God, what if it starts? What if it spreads? What if people start unionizing other places? What's going to happen? And that's really why I think we're seeing this crazy overreaction in the form of the tweets and the public statements and all that. So there's something's changing here.
Yes, couldn't agree more. Ken Klippenstein, reporter at The Intercept, please check out his great work and all of his pieces, including these three ones on Amazon and all the scoops he got. Thanks so much for coming on the show today, Ken.
My pleasure. Nice to see you again.
Nice to see you. We are going to take a quick break and we'll be right back. All right, we are back. Let's talk a little bit about the Derek Chauvin trial, shall we? I'm sorry, I just had a technical difficulty. You can see me okay, Matt, right?
Yes, I can.
You can hear me? Okay, great.
Yep.
The trial of Derek Chauvin continues. He is the officer who knelt on George Floyd's neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds until George Floyd died. And actually, he knelt on him after his pulse had already stopped for a few minutes. 61-year-old Charles McMillan, he was a witness to the murder, and he spoke on the stand at the trial yesterday. It was quite emotional. Here's that clip.
Mr. McMillan, do you need a minute?
Oh my God.
Just give you a moment, Mr. McMillan. I'm not sure if there's water as well. If you need a break to get some water, let me know. We can take a break. May I approach, Your Honor?
You may.
He says something at the end there. That's why I just wanted to play until the end, Matt. But I don't know.
Thank you.
Okay, actually, maybe not in this clip. I apologize. You get the picture about that trauma. So I wanted to play that because as this trial unfolds, I mean, this is going to be going down in the history books as one of the most important trials in the history of civil rights in this country. And I just thought that was such a deep display of trauma, internalized trauma from decades and decades of systemic racism. And then, of course, the trauma of seeing a man murdered right in front of you. And the trauma of the former of systemic racism is constantly rehashed in this trial, where Black witnesses are questioned specifically by the defense and essentially asked, for the most part, to prove racism exists to an audience that's probably already made up its mind that it doesn't. And I'm talking about the TV audience. I don't know what's going to happen with the jurors. But that conversation is such a microcosm of what we experience in America anyway, right? Where it's this gaslighting technique where white racists often, and in just a society that's built on so many pillars of white supremacy, is constantly asking Black America to display what racism is. And when they give concrete examples, they poke holes in it. And that's kind of what I see throughout this trial. And yet, a man crying in that way, breaking down, and he the quote that we didn't see there was that it really moved him when George Floyd was talking about his mother before he passed away, and how Charles McMillian talked about losing his own mother. You know, that's what I think is so, I guess, jarring and emotional about what we're seeing in this trial, is that it really is a visceral, emotional display of what it's like to be Black in America, and it's on people's television screens every day.
Yeah, let me just play this clip, Donna Williams II, who was the bystander, how they're trying to use that emotion against the witnesses here.
Yes.
You called him a tough guy.
I did.
You called him a real man.
I did.
You called him such a man.
I did.
You called him bogus.
I did.
You called him a bum at least 13 times.
That's what you counted in the video?
That's what I counted.
And that's what you got, 13.
And that was early on, right? Those terms grew more and more angry. Would you agree with that?
They grew more and more pleading for life.
All right. After you called him a bum 13 times, you called him a bum.
That's what you heard?
Did you say that?
Is that what you heard?
I'm asking you, sir.
I'm pretty
did
sure
you
I
say
did.
That?
You heard it. I'm pretty sure you did.
You call him a
if that's what you heard, I'm sure that's
I'm
what
asking
did.
You, did you say that?
If that's what the video recalled, that's what I did.
You called him a bit.
If that's the video you heard from the video?
It's a yes or no, sir.
If that's what was heard in the video, yes, I did.
And at one point, you said that Officer Tao pushed you.
That's correct. He put his hand in my chest, is what I said.
And you observed Officer Tao push someone else, right? Or feel like he pushed someone else?
I didn't let him touch anyone else.
Do you recall saying, "I dare you to touch me like that. I swear I'll slap the f*** out of both of you"?
Yeah, I did. I meant it.
Right. So again, sir, it's fair to say that you grew angrier and angrier.
No, I grew professional and professional. I stayed in my body. You can't pay me out to be angry.
Here's another microcosm of an experience of being Black in America. The defense attorney is trying to paint him as an angry Black man. What's the name of that? He's an MMA fighter.
Donna Williams II, yeah.
Don Williams. Don Williams didn't assault the officer. He didn't do anything. He didn't do anything to cause the murder of George Floyd. But in order to stoke racist fears in the jurors, this is what is being done here. And I guess, you know, win over racist America. It's to paint a bystander who was getting more and more upset by seeing a murder in front of him as an irrational, angry black man. And then the other side of the coin, Charles McMillian breaking down and being emotional about it, that'll be dismissed as, I don't know, whatever the next excuse will be. There's an opportunity to paint one witness as irrational and overly angry, and another opportunity to dismiss a witness as being over emotional and that his experience doesn't necessarily matter. That's what we're seeing in this trial. It's just infuriating. And yeah, I would love if he could have put, I mean, you can't do that when you're on the stand, but my question to this defense attorney would be like, how is this relevant in any way to the fact that George Floyd was murdered by this police officer? And what they're going to say is, and what the defense has already said their argument is going to be, is that the officer, Derek Chauvin, was so overwhelmed by the crowd's response, the growing crowd, as he was murdering somebody, that he couldn't help but do more murder. he was way too inflamed with emotion because people were asking him to stop killing somebody. Kind of circular in my view. Matt? Anything on that end, or shall we head into the fun half?
Yeah, I mean, no, I think you pretty much said it. If Don Williams wanted to be angry and irrationally so and violent, he could have been. He has the tools to. He was instead trying to save a man's life. And the idea that you would go over that with a fine-tooth comb as if it bears anything other than, like, the only relevance it has to me is, you know, what he must feel compared to, you know, other witnesses who said they wish they had done more. I assume he probably has some of those regrets too. And like, that's awful.
And not a burden that any of the witnesses should have to bear, including the testimony we heard from an 18-year-old woman who was a 17-year-old girl at the time. I mean, why does she have to bear guilt? Because an officer murdered a man in front of her. And again, that Don Williams is black. I mean, I'm not sure about the race of the 18-year-old witness, but it's very clear that if you're a black person trying to intervene in this murder, that your life could be in danger too. And yet, these witnesses are asked to take on the emotional burden of feeling guilt, or at least that's what they feel, which is just an understandable human emotion when you see someone get murdered in front of you. That's so emblematic of the black experience. There's so many tropes and obvious, just awful historical elements in this trial. And the clips we showed were indicative of that. Now let's head into the fun half, because we have a Marjorie Taylor Greene clip that I'm so excited about.
Yeah, before that, I just want to say tonight, 8 o'clock Eastern time.
I'm sorry, forget plugs.
Left Reckoning. Tonight, we have Brian Box Brown on to talk about pot legalization in different areas. A lot of things to watch out for and be aware of in terms of how states are doing this, things like not allowing home grow or, you know, those sorts of things. Also, he seems kind of okay on the New York state legalization, which seems interesting. So he's still digesting that, but we'll talk about that tonight. Patreon.com/Left Reckoning. But more importantly, go subscribe, YouTubers. Go subscribe to Left Reckoning on YouTube now so you can watch us tonight.
Yes, definitely do that. Everyone subscribe to Left Reckoning. The Noma Keisha will be on at 3 p.m. today. Not sure about her guests, but check it out. And in case you guys were wondering, yes, the intro this morning was a little bit different than one we'd heard before. We'll play it again for you, just in case it jogs your memory about what this is referencing.
The Majority Report. Everything shitty about liberals in one hunched over, lying, screaming, banal, trite human container. Like a one-stop shop museum for what is so repellent about liberal discourse. That's the Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Just a bit of a Twitter reference. Look it up, guys. Apparently, Sam is the Hunchback of Notre Dame. Let us head into the fun half, Matt.
Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook. Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.